who didn't believe in the Big Bang, Hoyle being the standard example. And he had a lot of explaining to do in order to try and make that work. And eventually, actually I'm not sure Hoyle died before he accepted it or not. But there's just a whole lot of evidence that you'd need to somehow find a way around not to believe in the Big Bang. And kind of first and foremost is why we're surrounded by this 3-degree temperature field in every direction. And why everything seems to be moving away from us. And why it all kind of makes sense. That is to say, we can actually look back in time by looking at distant objects, and it all works. Lots of interlocking evidence. And that's kind of the way science works. Science doesn't have usually one pillar. There isn't one thing that you can kick the support out from under and the theory falls. Things are usually supported by multiple independent lines of evidence. So when things first come up, they're usually supported by just one and they're shaky. But as time goes on, they have 1,000 different strands that are explained, and then it becomes really hard to break those strands. And it's interesting to study how that can happen, right? So Copernicus is an example of where Aristotle's theory, which had lots of independent lines of support, was overturned slowly, not at all quickly. So you see there are labs next week. If you look at the weather, it's not looking good. There's never been an occasion when I've taught this course that everyone has not gotten to see something at the observatory. And it sure looks like where that's headed. And if that happens, we'll have some sort of open time where you're not required to come, but you're allowed to come, and I'll be out there when we have a reasonable chance of it being clear. And the stars to know, I think I told you last time, that's going to be the next kind of 10-point question. It's not going to happen, obviously, this week. It's not going to, I don't think it'll happen next week. I haven't looked carefully at the schedule, but you should start to be learning those stars to know. And just as before, we'll start with the easier ones and work our way up the final one, which will be the winter hexagon, where there are 8 stars to know. So remember, they come in the winter hexagon, 2 groups of 3, and then 2 isolated examples, Polaris and Algol. Okay, so we've moved on from kind of talking about the solar system as a whole, where we divided up the planets in the terrestrials and the Jovians. And we talked last time about, and I guess I didn't write that on the board, we talked last time about the 1,000 new planets we have that are going around extra stars. And to me, I was talking to my colleague about this the other day, it's a little bit premature to be spending too much time on the exoplanets because we kind of don't have the big take. And for me, the takeaway message currently is that there are certainly solar systems that are way different from ours. But the story isn't quite in whether we're really odd or whether the ones that we detected first were odd. But in any case, we know that planets are not at all rare. It's probably the usual situation for stars to have planets. And we know that there are planets that are, it's hard to detect planets as small as the Earth. So we know that there are planets that are a little bit bigger than Earth and are more or less in the same spot as the Earth around some other stars. So it's looking like it's pretty likely that there's going to be life on other stars. And I suspect that you will live to hear a news story that says life has now been detected on this star that is at this spot in the sky. We're going to have that data from Kepler and the follow-on spacecraft in 10 years, 20 years sort of time scale, but not during. So when I say life, of course, I don't mean that Spock is going to be, we're going to see pictures of Spock. I mean that we're going to have evidence of microscopic life on some other planet. So, on to the Earth. The composition of the Earth's atmosphere is strange. It's strange, first of all, from a global perspective, in that most of the universe is made out of hydrogen and helium. Right? So 98%, 99% of the universe is made out of these two guys. Notice this, one of these funny scales. So Here we have 100 billion, and here we're just down to something like 100 million. So hydrogen and helium are almost everything. And then kind of the next ones that are common are carbon, oxygen, and neon. So carbon and oxygen are pretty common in our atmosphere. Neon is, it's not on the list. You have to go down a ways to get to neon. And the explanation for why we don't have neon is that it escapes because it's low mass. And you might argue, well, it's more mass than oxygen. How do we hang on to the oxygen? Well, remember, oxygen is a diatomic molecule. So it actually, in O2 form, it weighs more than neon, so it's going slow enough to be retained. And as we go down the list, nitrogen is kind of the next most common thing. So we do have lots of oxygen, more oxygen than nitrogen on this planet, but most of our oxygen is in the form of rocks. And we go down, then we start to see rocky stuff like silicon, magnesium, iron, etc. And of course, things like gold are relatively rare on our planet and in the solar system as a whole. So we explained long ago the absence of hydrogen and helium based on thermal velocities and the masses of the atoms. The oxygen was not there originally. So the existence of the banded iron formation in northern Minnesota with a date of about 2 billion years ago is signs that there was not oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere 2 billion years ago. So it's built up over time, and it's a product of photosynthesis. It's a product of life. And that's the sort of thing we would detect in another planet, in an exoplanet, that would be evidence of life. A chemical that would not normally be present, like oxygen, because it's highly reactive, it needs to be there by some biological process. So if we killed off all the plants, the oxygen would disappear in a few million years because it is chemically reactive. Layers. So we're going to be dividing lots of things up into layers in this class. And the question is, what are we going to use to distinguish various layers in our atmosphere? The composition is pretty much the same top to bottom, so we can't base our layers based on chemical composition, which we often will. But what we have is this very funny structure of temperature. Starting from the surface of the Earth, when you go up, it gets cold. If you climb Mount Everest, it gets cold. But if you're in a very high-flying airplane, it starts to get hot again. It gets pretty much as hot as it is at the surface. And then it gets cold again, and then it gets very, very hot, thousands of degrees hot. So we have this funny structure in our atmosphere. And the reason something is hot is because it's close to the flame, basically. And what we have here is heating at ground level. The sun is heating the Earth, and the Earth is heating the atmosphere. So that's why the bottom of the troposphere is hot. The very high energy type of light doesn't penetrate very far into our atmosphere. It's absorbed in the outer layers of the Earth's atmosphere, the X-ray light from the sun. And that turns out to be highly variable depending upon what the sun is doing in terms of various flares and such. So the temperature conditions out here in the exosphere do depend, are not at all consistent. What's going on here is we have to have a source of heating, and that source of heating is the absorption of the sun's ultraviolet light by ozone, O3. Okay, so we got these vocabulary words, troposphere, stratosphere, mesosphere. There are lots of kind of similar names for this outer region. It's ionized because of the absorption of this high energy light, so the ionosphere is one name for it. Because it's getting hot, people call it the thermosphere. Because this is where atoms could exit the Earth's atmosphere, it's sometimes called the exosphere. And I think our book calls it the exosphere. So that's the temperature structure of the Earth's atmosphere. In terms of pressure, pressure is just the weight of the overlying layers of air. So as you go up, there's less air, so there has to be less pressure. So the pressure just goes down, 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 down as you go up, up, up in the Earth's atmosphere. And we have, I know equations aren't going to play a big role in this course, but if you think about the relationship between the density of air and the pressure of air and the temperature of air, there has to be that sort of relationship. If you increase the pressure on air, the air will compress and therefore be at a higher density. If you increase the temperature of air, you know, hot air rises because it's low density. So that equation, which is called the ideal gas law, kind of explains the relationship between density, temperature, and pressure. And long ago, we said that the change in pressure depended upon the density of the material. So since the density itself depends on the pressure, we have an equation which says that the change is proportional to what you've got. And so that works kind of like interest in your bank account, hopefully, that as you go on, you get more and more and more in an exponential fashion as you go down in the Earth's atmosphere. And the exponential factor is called the scale height. It's about 8.5 kilometers. And it depends on the temperature of the atmosphere and the mass of the atoms that are making up the atmosphere and the local acceleration of gravity. Okay, questions on kind of the overall stuff? So this isn't a course in meteorology. There is a course in meteorology, but this isn't it. But there's some kind of general features I'd like to talk about for weather is maybe an overstatement, for climate on the Earth. And what I'm thinking about is what are the features that you would see in the Earth's atmosphere from a distant planet? If you were trying to figure out how the Earth works, what would kind of be the immediate things that you would see? And I guess what I would say is one of the things that you would notice is that cloud patterns, weather, generally speaking, seems to move from the west to the east. If you want to know what the weather here is going to be tomorrow, look to see what the weather is in Dakota today. So we want to explain why that's the case, why weather moves from west to east, at least at the mid-latitudes. Near the equator, they have kind of different sort of weather than we have here. Instead of having a sequence of high and low pressures go by, they typically have just thunderstorms that pop up. And this is the intertropical convergence zone, being a little bit distinct from the sort of weather that we have at the mid-latitudes. And also we have these kind of zones that you may have heard about back in grade school, right? The horse latitudes, the doldrums, the trade winds. Why does all of that work? So those are the sorts of things we'd like to understand about the climate of the Earth. And the starting point for that was the Coriolis force. So the Coriolis force is it's not one of the fundamental forces of nature. It's just a result of being on a spinning planet. So Venus, which has a very slow spin, has a pretty negligible Coriolis force. Jupiter, that's spinning faster than the Earth, has a larger Coriolis force. So it's not a force of nature, it's just a force of situation, namely planetary spin. And the extent to this force depends on the speed that an object is moving. So a fast-moving bullet will be affected more by this force than a slow-moving bullet. If we're on a fast-spinning planet, we'll have a larger force. And it also depends on where you are on the planet. So technically speaking, if you remember your trigonometry, it depends on the sine of the latitude. And all we really care about for us is that it's going to be zero at the equator and small in the vicinity of the equator, and it's going to be reversed by hemisphere. In terms of direction, the Coriolis force is to the right. So if something has a velocity that's this way in the northern hemisphere, it's going to feel a slight push to the right. If it's going this way, it's going to be pushed to the right. In the southern hemisphere, all of those things are reversed. And I guess the other kind of vocabulary we had was isobars. And this comes from what we're really trying to explain. These sorts of weather pictures that you may have seen where we have these lines. I hope it's clear these arrows are showing the wind direction. There's kind of a less realistic, but maybe easier to understand picture here. What these are regions on the surface of the Earth where the pressure is a constant value. In this case, 1,020 millibars, where Mars bar is a unit of pressure, where one bar is about equal to the usual pressure on Earth. Okay, so these things are like topographical maps. Here there's lots of pressure, and as we go out there's less pressure. Here there's a region like a steep part of a mountain where the pressure is changing quickly as you move horizontally. And we can do this with pressure, we can do this with any quantity. If we do this with temperature, then we're talking about isotherms. Questions? Okay, so the place I wanted to start was this general sort of circulation around these systems. And the one really funny thing is if this were the surface of a lake and the water was piled higher on one part of the lake than the other part, you would expect in relatively fast terms the lake would even out. But that's not the case with the Earth's atmosphere. Here, the air is piled higher than it is there, but it's not leveling itself out. The winds are actually blowing perpendicular to the obvious direction. And that's basically because the atmosphere is going to be observed to be in a stable situation. If the air could move from high to low, it would have already, and it already would have equalized it. So we're always going to observe situations that are in force equilibrium, and we clearly have here a force that is pushing this air that away, right, from high pressure to low pressure. So there has to be a force that's pushing it in the other direction that's keeping it from filling in. And that force is the Coriolis force, because this is from the northern hemisphere perspective. The air is moving this way, and we're going to have a Coriolis force that's going to be pushing it to the right. If this pressure difference were even more, so if we had the high and low pressure system even closer together, then there'd be an even bigger pressure force pushing this way, which would require an even bigger Coriolis force to balance it, which would mean even higher speeds of the air. So you'll notice that we get windy days when we have big pressure differences across the state, because the Coriolis force is needed to balance that force difference, and how it's going to do it is by having a bigger number for the speed of the air. So if we're thinking about a low pressure system, the air is going to feel a pressure force that is trying to push it towards the low pressure system. It needs to be balanced, so there needs to be a Coriolis force that's going that way. The only way it can do that is if the air is going that way, so that the Coriolis force is to the right. Pressure force is pushing this way, Coriolis force has to push that way, so the wind has to be blowing that way, so that the Coriolis force pushing it to the right is balancing the pressure force. Right? To the right. So you can see the result of this. In the northern hemisphere, we're going to get circulation that's in a counterclockwise direction around a low pressure system. Of course, everything is reversed in the southern hemisphere. If we have a low pressure system, again, the air wants to fill that in, we have to have a balancing Coriolis force, but it's going to be pushed to the left. So the air has to be going that way. So we need a force that's pushing this way. The Coriolis force can provide it if the wind is blowing that way. So we're going to have opposite circulation patterns around low and high pressure systems in the corresponding hemispheres. For a high pressure system, the air would like to escape. We're going to see an equilibrium situation, which means there has to be a Coriolis force pointing that way, which means the wind has to be blowing that way, so the Coriolis force is to the right.
So does the Coriolis force always point toward the equator?
Point towards the equator. No, it always points to the right. So if we have something in the United States, if you shoot a bullet that way, the Coriolis force is going to push things that way, to the east. If you shoot a bullet this way, due east, then the Coriolis force will push things to the right. So it's always to the right in the northern hemisphere.
Is there a way to calculate how far to the right?
Sure, yep. All you need is the force, and then combine that with Newton's law that says the force is going to be the mass times the acceleration, and you can calculate the amount of deflection. It's pretty small. So early on, when people were uncertain about this, go back to Newton, what they did to test out this theory is there were situations where they were making bullets. So the way you make bullets in those days is you wanted a round bullet, not the sort of bullet we have today. And of course, the natural shape of material is going to be round if it doesn't splot on the ground. So they would drop liquid lead at the top of a big enclosure, and by the time it hit the ground, it had cooled enough to solidify. And since it was doing that in free fall, it was going to be a spherical shape. So they went to those locations, and they noticed that if they used a plumb bob to show exactly where those lead drops should be hitting, you know, they should be hitting here, but instead they were hitting there, just a few millimeters away. So it's a pretty small effect for 30-story falls, or typical rifle bullets or things like that. It becomes noticeable when you're talking. So all of these things. I guess another thing I said about the Coriolis force is it affects pretty much big objects more than small objects. So if we're talking about naval guns, that's another place where this is a more noticeable effect as opposed to your deer hunting rifle. And of course, you don't really have to worry about this with your deer hunting rifle, because the way you do that is you shoot some, you have your gun fixed in a different particular direction, and you shoot 10 shots, and then you take your scope and you make sure that it points at where the bullets are going to hit. But now if you take your rifle and you go and hunt in Australia, you better resight it. Well, actually you don't, because it's probably only going to move a few millimeters, and usually you're shooting at something bigger than a few millimeters. But theoretically, it would shoot a little bit differently. But pretty small amount, millimeters for kind of human scale things. So people kind of were, there is an interest in making this effect on human scale objects, and you've all seen the pendulum out there. So the reason that pendulum processes is also the same thing. It's the Coriolis effect acting on it. Well, I'm not sure I like the word cause of the storm, but it certainly the circulation around the storm is just like the circulation storms around the Earth. So one thing that is very special about Jupiter's storm, the great red spot, is that it's been in continuous existence as long as we could have observed it, so for about 300 years. Whereas storms on the Earth dissipate after, maybe a month in the case of hurricanes. And it may well be that the faster spin is going to play a role in that. And it is, of course, interesting that the Great Red Spot isn't near the equator. It's at a southern latitude in that particular case. There are lots of kind of funny things about the Great Red Spot. But we'll wait till we talk about Jupiter. More questions? So another way of kind of getting a handle to remember these sorts of situations is to think about what kind of would have happened if we weren't in equilibrium. So if we weren't in equilibrium and we had a high pressure system, the air would try and escape, but it would be pushed to the right. So it's going to end up with that sort of circulation. We're going to end up with force balance. But you can kind of see how force balance occurs over time by seeing how, if it tried to escape, it would end up circulating around the high pressure system in any case. Okay, so that's how high and low pressure systems work. How do the jet streams work? Which is basically why we have circulation from west to east. So you remember this diagram. So here is kind of a cross section of the Earth's atmosphere. Here's the North Pole, here's the South Pole. This particular picture is taken in Northern Hemisphere summer. So you can see that temperatures are relatively warm here in North America, and temperatures are relatively cold in Australia for this particular time. And what these things are showing is that we have high-speed air that is moving from west to east at altitude, kind of pulling the whole thing around from west to east, and that these things exist at mid-latitude. And the jet stream is going to be stronger in the winter hemisphere than it's going to be in the southern hemisphere. So that's what we'd like to explain next. What is the cause of the jet streams? And I think myself that this is maybe the most complicated thing in this course. because it involves lots of kind of contradictory things. So again, what the jet streams are is high-speed air moving from west to east in each hemisphere, not at the surface, but at 10 kilometers up, something like that. So it must be being caused, again, by a force balance. Here's my map of the United States. So what we've got then is a jet stream that is moving like this. And how it must be working, it must be, of course, that the Coriolis force is trying to push that air to the right. So it must be that there's some other force that's pushing it northward. And that northward force is going to be pressure. So why would it be that there is always a pressure force that's pushing stuff to the north? That is to say, basically, why is there always high pressure system here and low pressure system there? Not at the surface, but at altitude.
Is it because the planet spinning in the atmosphere is kind of
like... So what is certainly true, and I think is easy to understand, is that it's going to be hot here, and it's going to be cool here. And that is a result, of course, of the heating of the Earth, right? The sun is approximately speaking over the equator, but more appropriately over the tropics, and so those are the parts that are going to get the majority of the sun's heating. So somehow or other, these temperature differences have to be causing pressure differences at altitude. Right? So even if the pressure is the same in Minneapolis and in Austin at the surface, I'm claiming that the pressure at altitude is going to be different. And that's going to be caused because the density of the air is different. If we have high temperature air, it's going to be low density air, which means the pressure is going to change less as you go up into the Earth's atmosphere. Right? So here we go up, say, half a kilometer, and we're at 900 millibars. We do the same thing at Austin, and it's pressure hasn't gone down so much. So hot air, the pressure is going to go down slower because hot air is less dense. Cold air is dense air, so when we go up, the pressure is going to go down faster. So automatically, on top of cold air, you go up 10 kilometers in cold air, you go up 10 kilometers in hot air, the pressure is going to be higher when you go up in the hot air. So at altitude, not at the surface, but at altitude, this will be high and this will be low. And that's what's going to cause this pressure force that's going to be balanced by the Coriolis force by having this air move at high speed from west to east. Okay, so let's try and think about how, I can't really draw Australia, it just looks kind of like a blob to me. So here we've got our penguins down here in the south. Let's try and work the same story here. So of course here, in the direction of the equator, it's going to be hot. Here it's going to be cool. So even if it's the same pressure on the surface, when we go up, the pressure is going to be higher here than it's going to be there. The pressure changes quickly in a dense material compared to a less dense material. So there's going to be a pressure force that is trying to push the air towards the South Pole. It'll be balanced by having air move at high speeds from west to east because the Coriolis force is going to be pushing to the left in the southern hemisphere. Okay, so we have kind of a double reversal. The direction of the temperature change and the direction of the Coriolis force are both reversed in the southern hemisphere, so we still have west to east flow in our jet streams. So the location of the jet stream, of course, is going to be where the temperature difference is most extreme. And in fact, that's typically where you hear it on television weather, right? They're interested in knowing where where we have the difference between the cold Canadian air and the warmer continental air, and that's exactly where we expect the jet stream to be. The contrast between cold and hot will be more extreme in the winter hemisphere, and so the jet stream will be more important in the winter hemisphere than it is in the southern hemisphere, in the summer hemisphere. Okay, so all of this complicated story goes under the name thermal wind. And again, the story is that temperature differences yield pressure differences, not at the surface, but up high. And the reason is we have different densities of air. High temperature air is low density air. And so as a result, the pressure changes less as you go up. And these pressure differences up high in combination with the Coriolis force is what making the jet streams. And it's a simplification to say that the jet streams are these straight patterns. They actually kind of meander around, but they're always moving from, generally speaking, from west to east. Okay. Let me kind of re-show this cross-section too, just to keep these things in mind. So we're usually thinking about isobars like this that are at the surface, but we also have to think about this three-dimensionally, right? So any place you go, when you go up, the pressure is getting less, less, less. So there's this kind of three-dimensional basis for these isobars. Questions? So there's kind of a general trend in the circulation around the Earth. And this is kind of the picture that I hope you learned about in grade school. So this is the, of course, how it worked at the early Europeans getting to North America. They could go south into these trade winds, so the winds would blow them towards America, and then they could go north to come back and catch those winds. And in between, we had the so-called horse latitudes, where the winds were light or variable. And similarly, around the equator, we have light or variable winds in this intertropical convergence zone. So this pattern is never as clear as it is in this diagram. So it's not, I mean, you know that the wind here is not always from the west, it's just, you know, 55% of the time from the west, as opposed to being 50-50. So it's not like this is a perfect correspondence. But if we average things out, we start to see some systematic trends. So first of all, here's a nice, doesn't show up very well, does it? This is real data showing the jet streams. In this case, this is the winter hemisphere this time, and we have these strong winds going from west to east at altitude, not particularly at the surface. This is intentionally reversed so that it matches the same way as that does. So what is this a diagram of? So here, we were talking about winds that are in the east-west direction. That's what was being plotted here. And that's, generally speaking, winds move parallel to the surface of the Earth. They don't go up or down very much. But if you've ever been in an airplane, you know you can feel the bumps in the level flying airplane, and that must be because air is going up and going down in some locations. Right, so there are thermals where the air is rising, that birds can maintain altitude without flapping their wings, and there are downdrafts where the reverse is the case. So if we average all of that out, we get this sort of diagram. And what this is showing, the blue is showing regions where the air is, on average, rising, and the yellow is showing regions, on average, where the air is falling. And mostly what I wanted to show you this for is to see that the Earth does have some very definite zones where we have upswells and downswells that aren't exactly obvious. And these are the source of the doldrums and the horse latitudes. Because where the air is rising, that's where we're going to have a tendency to have thunderstorms in the intertropical convergence zone, where we're taking moist air and bringing it up where it's cold so it can rain down. On the other hand, in this sort of region where we have air that was cold falling, that's a situation for not having clouds and rain. So this is where we're going to have the horse latitudes of relatively low low winds, horizontal winds. These are, again, vertical winds that are being displayed. So roughly speaking, what's happening here is a version of convection. So you remember we talked about these three methods of energy transfer. We've got radiation, convection, and conduction. Conduction, turns out, is not particularly important in weather or astrophysically, but it's maybe the most normal sort of thing. So that's why a metal spoon will get hot at its end if its bowl is in boiling water, whereas a wood spoon won't. The wood is less conductive of heat. None of this material is actually in bulk motion from the lip of the spoon to the end of the spoon. It's just propagated vibration. Convection has to do with taking material that is hot and moving it. And usually convection is used in the sense of natural convection. And if you think about your boiling pot of water, you know that the water on the bottom is going to be hot because of basically contact with the flame. And it's going to therefore automatically have expanded because it's hot, and it will rise. And it'll be filled in with cooler water falling. So we have kind of automatic stirring that occurs because of convection. And we have a kind of a similar sort of process that is happening tangentially. That is to say, the sun is heating near the equator. And we expect, somehow or other, this heat is going to be transferred to the pole. And you can imagine that there might be some big convection cell that would connect the North Pole and the equator, you know, presumably symmetrically, hot air rising, falling at the poles, and having that sort of convection pattern around the Earth. And it turns out we can do these experiments with different spin rates, and that is pretty much what happens at low spin rate. But as you have faster and faster spinning planets, it turns out that this convection cell breaks up into any number of smaller convection patterns. So the more spin rate, the more breaking up you have of the individual convection cells. And basically that's caused by the Coriolis force pushing things aside, keeping them from going all the way from the equator to the North Pole. And this is the situation we have on our planet. We've got a region of hot air rising at the equator. We've got a region kind of at 30 degree latitudes where we have that air falling. And then here at 60 degrees, we have a repetition. And we've got another one at the very far part of the pole. So we have this kind of three-layer process of convection that is net-net transferring heat from the hot equator to the rest of the planet. Okay, so we should expect to see similar things in other planets. Slow rotating planets, that convection cell is probably going to go from pole to equator. Faster spinning planets, we should expect that it's going to be divided up into more of these little layers. For our planet, the effect really isn't particularly obvious. If you were to look at I'm sure you've seen pictures of the Earth, you don't see a definite banding. This banding is only obvious when we look at big averages. And then we can see this pattern of rising air at the equator, falling air at, say, 30 degrees, rising air again, these series of convection cells that are making this broad picture of the overall circulation around the planet. Here it is. All right, so rising, falling, rising, falling. A series of subtle but present bands around the planet. Okay. Well, when we're on this topic of convection, it might be worth spending a second to think about how this works. So if we're thinking about this pot of water, how big does the temperature difference need to be before we start this process of convection? Right? So some temperature difference between the top and the bottom of the pan is required before convection is going to occur. And that's called the lapse rate, the change in temperature with altitude that's necessary to start convection. And the lapse rate for natural convection turns out to be related to the specific heat and the acceleration of gravity. But roughly speaking, it depends on the mass of the atoms that are making up your fluid, this constant that's called Boltzmann's constant, and the acceleration of gravity. And for the Earth's atmosphere, you can calculate it. It's on the order of 10 degrees Kelvin, Celsius if you prefer, per kilometer. It's actually a little bit less than that, but in round numbers, 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer. And it turns out that our atmosphere is typically a little bit sub lapse rate, so that our atmosphere isn't typically having vertical motions like this, but it's just a little bit under it. Right? So we're talking about here in the troposphere. We have situations, particularly around thunderstorms, where we have convection, where the temperature difference between the top and the bottom of the atmosphere is more than this 10 degrees per kilometer, and that's when we get these big convection cells that are running. So those things kind of keep us close to, but not exactly, but typically less than the lapse rate that's necessary for convection. So mostly we don't have much in the form of vertical motions in our atmosphere, but occasionally we do. So as we go down, automatically as we go down into a convective atmosphere, we expect the temperature to increase at the lapse rate, which just depends on the acceleration of gravity and the mass of the atoms that are making up the atmosphere and this Boltzmann constant. So how does it work for a radiation atmosphere? So if you think about the sun, which may seem like not at all like a planet, but it's not that uncommon. Obviously, as you go, the sun, of course, like Jupiter and the Jovian planets, doesn't have a surface, but it has a layer where we go from transparent to opaque, that we usually call the surface of the sun, right? So there's nothing different fundamentally between this piece of the sun and that piece of the sun. It turns out that what is different is that this piece of the sun is slightly ionized, and so as a result, it has become opaque. But it's still hydrogen and helium in the top box and in the bottom box. So how does the temperature change as we go down into the sun's atmosphere or any planet's atmosphere for that matter that is dominated by radiation loss? So if you think about how this has to work for a piece of light, it's going to go some distance before it's absorbed in this opaque material. And then it's going to be re-emitted in a random direction. So we have this kind of random walk of light out before it reaches the region where the atmosphere is actually transparent. It can work its way through. So a key parameter in this story is going to be how big the step size is. So this is usually called the mean free path, and I guess I'll just denote it by mean free path, MPF. And what we're going to deal with mostly is called the optical depth. So these are vertical distances that are described as multiples or fractions of the mean free path. And it's usually denoted by this Greek letter tau. So if we're three, if tau is equal to 3, that means we're three steps from the surface of the star. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen in 3 steps. It might, right? You might make 3 lucky guesses to go that way, but it's very likely that you're going to rattle around in here quite a while before you actually work your way out. In fact, roughly speaking, if you're 3 optical depths deep, it's going to take you 9 steps to get out, and so it goes. So how does the temperature in the sun's atmosphere depend on the optical depth? And you can be pretty sure that it's going to increase with optical depth, but roughly speaking, the temperature of the sun is going to be the effective temperature of the sun. That's what we've talked about, basically the 6,000 degrees, what we usually talk about, the effective temperature of the sun. And then the optical depth plus 2/3. Again, the precise equation has no important relevance to us. The idea is just simply that as you go down into the sun or any situation where it's dominated by radiation transfer, the temperature is going to increase with this parameter. Okay, so we have energy transfer by convection, energy transfer by radiation, and conduction, it turns out, not typically to be important in astronomical situations. So how does it work for the Earth? What's the dominant form of energy transfer? And it turns out the answer is yes, kind of unfortunately. We have kind of a mix of energy transfer by convection and radiation, so that I can't say it's as simple as one or the other. So let's take a look at the energy balance for the Earth as a whole. Here it is. So here's kind of the overall situation on average, right? So the Earth isn't homogeneous. There are parts of it that are dark, parts of it that are bright. But on average, if we have 100 units of energy coming from the sun, it turns out that about 2 of those units are ultraviolet light, and they're absorbed above the troposphere and the stratosphere. About 20% of it is absorbed in the atmosphere as a whole. A good fraction of it hits the Earth's surface and it's absorbed there. Oh, this is actually on a cloudless condition. So that's why as much as 61% of it is reaching the surface of the Earth. Some of it is going to be reflected off the Earth. Some of what heats the Earth is going to be re-radiated. That is to say, blue sky light is also illuminating the surface of the Earth. In that case, we're going to have 10 units of energy that are coming right from the atmosphere as opposed to from other places. And of course, some of that blue sky light is going to shine out into space in addition. Right, so this is a situation where we have a relatively small albedo, where most of the sun's light is being absorbed by the Earth. So here's kind of a more realistic composite feature where we have a lot of overcast. Now relatively little of the sun's light is going to reach the surface of the Earth. We're going to have a lot more reflected from the white clouds, and we're going to have energy deposition in the clouds, above the clouds, below the clouds, and of course some in the stratosphere, which is not much of interest. So on average, here's the situation. We've got 35% of the sun's light reflected from the planet without being absorbed, so that's an albedo of 35%. We've got 43 units that are going to be absorbed in the surface of the Earth, and we've got 20 units of energy that are actually going to be absorbed in the bulk of the atmosphere. So let's see how that energy balance works out. So we've seen that 63 units of energy are going to come from the sun, and you might guess from that that the bulk of the heating of the planet comes from the sun. But that turns out not to be the case. So here we have infrared light that's emitted by the troposphere, and it's going to produce 102 units of energy. Right? So more than twice as much of the heating of the surface of the planet comes from the atmosphere. And if you think about it, it kind of has to be that way. When the sun goes down, it doesn't immediately cool off. We're still surrounded by all of this hot air. That hot air is producing infrared light, which is constantly heating us. We don't see this light with our eyes, but it's always doing this heating. Okay, so the Earth is hot, so it's also emitting infrared light. So it's emitting 116 units of energy, but very little of that actually escapes. Almost all of that doesn't go very far. It's absorbed by the troposphere. So this is a situation where we see that the Earth's atmosphere is largely transparent to the sun's light, but it's largely opaque to the Earth's light. So relatively little of the Earth's light is getting out. Most of it is being absorbed locally. A lot of that will be re-emitted and back to heating the Earth's atmosphere. So some people use the word trapping to describe that, and I don't like that word. When you trap a critter, you've got it forever. This energy is only temporarily here. It's detained. Right? So the sun's light is going to be detained in this cycle of being emitted from the Earth and absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. So that's not the only way the Earth has to cool. The Earth can transfer turbulent energy, that is to say we can have wind energy that's the result of the Earth. It can transfer some energy to the troposphere. We have evaporation, which is latent heat, which can also send energy back to the troposphere. But if we add all of these things up, right, the energy we get from the sun, the energy we emit, latent heat, on average, the Earth is, of course, in balance. As much energy it takes in is what it's going to lose. Okay, so we see from this that the Earth's light, right, the light that I've shown you lots of times, the spectra that we have from the Earth, that doesn't literally come from the ground. Most of that light is coming from the troposphere. And so the temperature that we calculate with our nifty formula is the temperature of this region of the Earth's atmosphere. And of course, because we're deep under that layer, as we go down, we're automatically hotter. How much hotter are we than that emitting surface layer? Well, you can take your pick of your favorite equation, right? You could use the convective lapse rate, or you could use this optical depth formula. But unfortunately, there isn't a nice formula that applies to all, because we don't. Our atmosphere is not dominated either by convection or by radiative losses. But no matter how you figure it, the thicker the layer that we have between us and that circulation, that emitting layer, the greater the temperature is going to be on the surface. Okay, so this is all very analogous to how blankets work. Right, so I take it you know that if you take a dead body and cover up with a blanket, it doesn't keep warm, right? The only reason you're warm under a blanket is because you have a heat source under the blanket. And you will soon be in equilibrium, so let's say the 50 watts of energy you're constantly producing because you're alive will have an equilibrium eventually where the energy that's lost through the blanket is exactly the same energy as you're producing. Right? So for a while we'll build up heat under the blanket, but we'll reach equilibrium when the energy that's deposited from the chemical processes in our body are matched by the radiative losses from the top of the blanket. So things are really controlled by the temperature difference between the inside and the outside of the blanket. The bigger the temperature difference between the inside and the outside of the blanket, the more energy that's going to be lost through that blanket. And we reach equilibrium eventually when we have the two being in equilibrium. So, I don't know, what I think is often helpful is a mechanical analogy. So, let's make an analogy to a bucket of water. So, in this analogy, the depth of this water is like the temperature difference between the inside and the outside of the blanket. And just like with water, if the temperature difference between the inside and the outside of the blanket is small, we're not going to get a big flow from that hole. On the other hand, if the temperature difference between the inside and the outside of the blanket is large, that is to say, if the depth of the water is deep, then we're going to get a big outflow. Okay, so the bucket of water with a hole represents the blanket. The amount of energy we have under the blanket, the temperature, is like the depth of the water. And the rate of loss through the blanket depends on the temperature difference. The bigger the temperature difference, the more the rate of loss, just like with a hole in the bucket. What this heat source coming in under the blanket is like some faucet that is dripping water into the bucket. And if you start out with an empty bucket, if you start out cold, of course, what's going to happen is the water level is going to increase, but eventually we're going to reach a situation where the amount of water in the bucket that's coming into the bucket is exactly matched by the rate that water is leaving the bucket. So I wouldn't call that water trapped in the bucket, right? It's just detained. If we plug up this hole a little bit, then the water level is going to rise. If we cut a bigger hole in it, then the water level is going to fall. But no matter what, we're going to reach an equilibrium situation if we wait long enough. Okay, so if we increase the thickness of our blanket, what that means is for the same temperature difference, less heat is going to escape. So it's the equivalent of cutting down the size of this hole. And so automatically then the water level is going to rise. If we bring a puppy with us under the blanket, right, we're going to have more heat that's being dumped. That's equivalent to dumping more water into this bucket. And other things being equal, the water level is going to rise. The temperature is going to rise under the blanket. Okay. So, what is determining the rate of loss of energy for our planet as a whole? So, if we look at that spectrum, always too much and I always put them in a funny place after I'm done with them. Huh? I want that one in a second. All the way over here. So if we look at this spectra, what's the most striking feature of it? Well, the most striking feature is that it's not one of these nice bell-shaped curves that we've always had in the past. There's this big gap in it. There's lots of energy that should be emitted, but isn't emitted. That is to say, there's an absorption line. And the absorption line is labeled carbon dioxide. And I think we commented before on the kind of unusual nature of this. Our atmosphere is mostly made out of homonuclear diatomics like N2 and O2. Other examples of homonuclear diatomics would be chlorine and hydrogen. Right, so homonuclear means the same nucleus, diatomic means two things together. And it turns out that when these things vibrate, they don't have a net change in the charge of the electrons. They're symmetrical, and so they don't radiate and they don't absorb. In contrast to carbon dioxide, which has a variety of unsymmetrical modes of vibration, and therefore, boy, third time's the charm. I think there's only two sides. And therefore, they can absorb light by running these vibration modes. So that's why we don't see any prominent absorption lines from any of the usual constituents of the Earth's atmosphere. Nitrogen, oxygen, there's nothing to vibrate in argon because it's a monatomic molecule. So it's only the rare constituents in the Earth's atmosphere that contribute to this curve, that keep the light from escaping, that hold the light in. So here we have ozone, carbon dioxide, water. Those are the main contributors to the opacity in the Earth's atmosphere. So if we increase the opacity of the Earth's atmosphere, so what that would mean would be, for example, making the mean free path be even bigger. Right, so if we make the mean free path be smaller, the same height difference is going to correspond to a larger optical depth, and that's going to automatically mean that the temperature is going to be hotter on the surface. Or configure it the other way, if the Earth's atmosphere is more opaque, then that means that the temperature that we're calculating is now up higher in the Earth's atmosphere. And it's going to be 10 degrees per kilometer before we reach the surface. So we've added more kilometers at 10 degrees per kilometer to the distance between the emitting layer and the surface, so it's going to get hotter on the surface. Okay, so I hope it's clear that all this has to do with the greenhouse effect. So the greenhouse effect has to do with detaining more of the sun's energy in the Earth's atmosphere by making it more and more difficult to escape, by effectively decreasing the size of this hole. Now, it's not going to lead to anything catastrophic, right? If we decrease the size of this hole, the water level goes up, the temperature at the surface of the Earth goes up, but it doesn't go up forever. We eventually reach equilibrium again, where we have as much energy coming from the sun as is leaving from the surface of the Earth. Okay, so two ways to think about that. One way is if the Earth's atmosphere is made more opaque by increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide, then the emitting layer goes up and it's 10 degrees per kilometer down from there. So if you increase the height of the emitting layer, it's going to be hotter on the surface of the planet. Or if you're thinking radiation is the dominant method of energy transfer, if we decrease the mean free path, then the optical depth to the surface of the Earth is going to be more, and so the temperature at the surface of the Earth is going to increase. So any way you think about it, if we increase the opacity of the Earth's atmosphere, it's going to make it hotter and hotter and hotter, with maybe some provisos. So there's another kind of important effect that I hope you've heard about, nuclear winter. Right? So people are claiming it's going to get hot or cold. So what's involved in so-called nuclear winter? So the nuclear and nuclear winter is referring to nuclear war. So the presumption in this circumstance is that a nuclear war occurs and the cities all around the world burn. So that what we have then is a dust cloud. We have an opaque cloud that covers all of the Earth. And what that's going to mean is that there won't be any heat under the bottom of the blanket. Right? Because there won't be any heating from the sun to get through that opaque cloud. And the only reason it was hot under the blanket is because there was a heat source there. So if we cut off heating the surface of the planet, we now have a dead body under the blanket, and the temperature underneath the blanket will be the same as the temperature on top of the blanket. So the temperature where this opaque cloud is will be the same as the temperature on the surface of the planet. And that temperature is cold. Someplace not up as high as the stratosphere, but maybe as high as Mount Everest, which is, you know, not a pleasant place to live. So if we cut off the heat source to the surface of the Earth, the planet is going to cool. If we increase the opacity of the Earth's atmosphere, the planet is going to heat. Now it's, I think, useful to think about, you know, in some sense, the absurdity of all of this. So we think about spitting in the ocean, right? It's not going to change what the ocean is much like. It's kind of hard to think about polluting the ocean because it's just so big. And you might think the same thing about the Earth's atmosphere, right? How could we affect the Earth's atmosphere? But we don't have to change the Earth's atmosphere. All we have to do is change a minor constituent in the Earth's atmosphere. The majority of the Earth's atmosphere is irrelevant as far as this process goes. The oxygen, the nitrogen, they could be there or not, and it doesn't really matter. So it's only this very minor constituent in the Earth's atmosphere, carbon dioxide, ozone, water, none of those things reach a percent level. We can affect the concentration of these guys, and we have. So we can measure that. Here's a very small, we now have a data set that's, I think, like 50 years long. Here's a very small piece of it. There's a bigger piece of it in the book. So Hawaii has been in the business of measuring the concentration of carbon dioxide. It's a great place to do it because the air is coming clean from the ocean, so there aren't any nearby pollution sources. And we see that there's this general trend, which has continued since the 70s, up, 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 up. This oscillation, I think, is really interesting. So that has to do with the difference between the amount of land in the southern hemisphere and in the northern hemisphere. So when we have northern hemisphere summer, we have lots of green plants growing and they eat carbon dioxide. And so we have a relatively small amount of carbon dioxide. Summer in the southern hemisphere doesn't help so much because there isn't as much green land mass down there. But you can see, continuing up to, I forget what the current levels are, I think around more than 350. Because of burning fossil fuels like coal, we're increasing noticeably the concentration of this relatively rare, right? This is parts per million, this relatively rare component of the Earth's atmosphere, which is guaranteed to heat the surface of the planet. Okay, so a little bit more atmosphere next time, and then on to geology, I hope.